So let's get into this a little gradually. First of all, the Ater Zimbris. The Khatiyas are mentioned first. The Khatiyas, or Kshatriyas in Sanskrit, are the nobles, the warriors. They are the land-owning ruling class, or rather caste, of ancient India. The Buddha himself was born into this particular caste, the caste of the Khatiyas or Kshatriyas, as also was Ananda. But of course the Buddha did not attach any importance to hereditary caste, and no distinction of caste was observed within the Sangha or spiritual community which he founded. On one occasion the Buddha said that just as the great rivers of India, on reaching the ocean, the mighty ocean, lost their separate identities, their separate names, so on becoming members of his Sangha, his spiritual community, people from the different castes, Kshatriya, Brahmana, Vaishya, Shudra, and so on, they lost their identities as members of those particular castes, and they all became, regardless of their social origin, simply sons and daughters, spiritual sons and spiritual daughters of the Buddha. Then the Brahmins, of course, were the hereditary priests. The hereditary priests of, for what wasn't exactly Hinduism then, it was more like Vedism. The Brahmins believed in the Vedas, the four Vedas. They believed in them not just as literary documents, in fact they were transmitted orally, they believed in them as revealed truth, as divine revelation. And the Brahmins officiated at a variety of sacrifices, including even animal sacrifice, based on Vedic texts. And the Brahmins, of course, were very keen on maintaining their socio-religious status. In later generations, the Brahmins liked to style themselves as gods on earth. And the Buddha, it's not surprising to learn, clashed with them on a number of occasions because he did not accept their hereditary pretensions. Some Brahmins, of course, in fact quite a number of Brahmins, actually became the Buddha's disciples. Shariputra, for instance, was by birth a Brahmin. Shariputra is usually regarded as the chief disciple of the Buddha. His official title was the Dhammasenapati, which means the commander-in-chief of the Dharma. So this reminds us of this quality of courage. You can't be a commander-in-chief, even of an ordinary army, without courage. Unless you stay right behind the lines, of course, as sometimes happens nowadays. And if you are going to be the commander-in-chief of the Dhamma, the spiritual truth, well, you need more courage, far more courage, infinitely more courage, even than an ordinary commander-in-chief. So, where were we? Yes. So Sariputra, despite his birth as a Brahmin, became one of the Buddha's disciples. And then there's the assembly of householders, the Gahapatis. They were the heads of families. Of course, in India in those days, as in India still today, families weren't nuclear, they were joint families. You could have 15, 20, 30, 40, up to 100 people all living under the same roof or collection of roofs as one family, with a single head, the Gahapati. And these householders, these Gahapatis, especially were engaged in economic activities, in trade. And then we have the ascetics. These were the non-Vedic, even anti-Vedic, religious wanderers and teachers, the freelancers. Well, they were the sort of, you know, alternative people of those days, we could say, yeah? The Pali word for them is samana. Samana means one who makes an effort. That is to say, of course, a spiritual effort, an effort in the direction of personal spiritual development. The Buddha's contemporaries, according to the Pali scriptures especially, the Buddha's contemporaries regarded him as a Samana. He was usually referred to as Samana Gotama. To his disciples, of course, he was the Mahasamana, the great Samana. Now, Kshatriyas, Brahmins, householders, and ascetics, the members of these first four out of the eight assemblies, are of course all human beings. Kshatriyas, Brahmins, householders, and ascetics, all human beings. But the members of the next four assemblies are not human beings at all. They're what we may describe as supernatural beings. Or perhaps I should say supernormal beings, because according to Buddhism, the supernatural, in this sense, is also natural. It's natural in the sense that it's included within the realm of what Buddhists call conditioned existence, included within the higher reaches of the samsara. Now, in this particular text, the one from which I've been reading, describing the eight assemblies, the Buddha mentions only four kinds of supernatural beings. But if we look at the Pali text as a whole, we'll find about 30 different kinds mentioned, about 30 different kinds of supernatural or supernormal beings. All this is, of course, much too complicated to go into this evening. Fascinating though it might be, if we had time. So I'm going to simplify things. I'm going to lump the members of the fifth and sixth assemblies together, and I'm going to translate the Buddhist terms into the roughly corresponding Christian ones. So in this way, we have an assembly, a double assembly, we may say, of angels, of two different kinds. But there are still two assemblies left. And I'm going to continue to translate into the roughly corresponding Christian terms. We've got the assembly of Maras and the assembly of the gods of the 33. So, the assembly of Maras, let's render it as the assembly of Satans. And the other assembly, let's render it as the assembly of archangels. So, the Buddha, the text tells us, appears in all eight of these assemblies. The Kshatriyas, the Brahmins, householders, ascetics, and then using the Christian terms, angels, Satans, and archangels. But before appearing in any of them, what does he do? He says he adopts their appearance and speech. In other words, he does what St. Paul says he does. He becomes all things to all men. Of course, in this case, all men and all gods. But he does this on an even grander scale. We may say he becomes all things not only to all men, but to all angels, all archangels, and even to all Satans. And a very important principle is involved here. If you like, you can put aside the mythological framework, if it bothers you, as it might, and just concentrate on the principle that's involved here. The principle involved here is that if you want to communicate with people, and don't forget the Buddha entered these assemblies to communicate the Dhamma, if you want to communicate people, you must meet them halfway. You must even adopt their appearance. Look like them. You must speak their language, both literally and metaphorically. And this principle applies at all levels, from the highest to the lowest. From a Buddha's communication to those who are not Buddhas, to our own communication with one another. But you may ask, why is it necessary for us to adopt the appearance of those to whom we speak or with whom we are trying to communicate? Why is it necessary? We can understand perhaps why it's necessary for us to speak their language. If we didn't speak their language, whether literally or metaphorically, of course, they wouldn't understand us. But why do we need to look like them? Why do we appear? Why do we need to appear as one of them in the interests of effective communication? We can say that in the case of the Buddha, if he had appeared as the Buddha, as he really was in truth and reality, it would have been too much. It would have been too much for them, whether they were gods or whether they were human beings. It would have been rather like, you know, to take an illustration from classical Greek mythology, it would be like Zeus appearing to Semele in his full splendor. And you know what happened to Semele, those who remember your Greek mythology well, when Jupiter did appear as himself, as Zeus, at her rather foolish and rash request, she was simply burnt up by that overpowering splendor. And there's also a little parallel to that in the Christian tradition, because according to the Gospel, at the time of the Transfiguration, the three disciples of Jesus who witnessed the Transfiguration were confused and frightened. They could not bear it, presumably because they'd had a glimpse of Jesus as he really was.